Thank you very much again for the department for inviting me to do this talk. This is joint work with my colleagues Bess Bugodi and John Goldthorpe at Oxford, and who are both sociologists. John Goldthorpe in particular is an extremely well-known and eminent sociologist who has worked on these topics for now well over 50 years. So based on their work, I will start with a substantive research question, which I will explain. Then I'll move from it to a methodological, statistical research question and talk about that. And then at the end of the talk, return back to the substantive research question. So this has the structure of what applied statistics should be. There's a question motivated by some substantive area and questions that arise there, for which the methodological tools are not yet perfect. So the statistician then abstracts out of that a structure and a question for which the statistician tries to build better tools or improve the existing tools, then turns around and applies them again initially to the problem that motivated the question and then hopefully elsewhere as well. So starting with the sociological research question, to what extent can lack of intergenerational relative social class mobility in Britain be accounted for by class differences in education? A long question, and I'll explain the bits of it to begin with. There's a sub-question to this, which is basically saying, whatever the answer to the first, the main question is, how does the answer vary in different contexts for men and women in different times, etc.? And I'll come back to that as well. Then the statistical research question, to which we get eventually, is this one. How can we carry out mediation analysis of population associations between categorical variables? And again, eventually I will explain what all that means. But starting with the sociological one, to motivate why all of this is being done, intergenerational and mobility. Intergenerational means between parents and their children. And mobility means a comparison between parents and their children in some aspect of social position. So a person is mobile, intergenerationally mobile, if they are in a different position from their parents. They are immobile if they are in the same position as their parents. Now, what position here means, there are various different possibilities. Economists, for example, are very keen on income mobility. So they study how a person's income is different or similar to their parents' income. What I'm going to talk about today is mobility in social class, which is, at least sociologists do that a lot, and it has some good reasons for why they would focus on that. Even for social class and social class mobility, there are still further changes. It's a complex concept, as you may imagine, and a sort of charged concept, especially in the British context, for example. I'm going to use a very specific version or definition and operationalization of social class, which is very strongly associated with the life's work of John Goldthorpe, among others. And this is one that is defined entirely based on occupational relations, essentially sort of the amount of autonomy a person has in his or her job and to another extent, whether they have a sort of authority over others, managerial roles or not. And that is here measured using a certain classification known as NSX, stands for National Statistics Socioeconomic Classification. It's part of the UK official statistics, so it's used to classify social class in this respect. And to explain more clearly what it looks like, here's the version I use, the 7-class version. So the labels of the classes give you a general idea of what sort of occupations go where. In many of my examples, I'll focus on classes 1 and 7. It's often useful to think of the extremes to keep ideas clear in the mind. So number 1, higher managerial, administrative, and professional occupations, for example. Almost all university faculty is in class 1, higher professional occupations. Class 7, routine occupations, which is roughly what it sounds like, and others in between. Now, we have this for the parents and their children, in my case, adult respondents and their parents, for that mobility business. And we'll then refer to these two classes as origin class and destination class. Origin, your parents' class, destination is where you come from. Destination, your class, is where you are now yourself. Right. So now I'm ready to at least introduce most of my data because I've introduced the main ideas there. So this will use data from three studies, from UK. These are all UK data, so-called birth cohort studies. What happened in those was very simple. Essentially, all children born in Britain in 1 week of a given year were included in a cohort and then follow up forever. So there are three of them, 1946, 1958, and 1970. There is also a fourth, the so-called millennium cohort, but they are from 2000, so they're not old enough to be in this study yet. What was I going to say there? Yes, so that's kind of how it works. And we treat them as basically samples of people born in that around that time. Do it separately for men and women with certain choices. There are various things that I'm not going to focus on today. Missing data in these data sets in the variables I'm considering has been multiply imputed before all of this started. So in fact, the analysis are all multiple imputation estimates, but I'm not going to say anything about that. Sample sizes for these six combinations of three cohorts and men and women separately, it's somewhere in between 1,000 and 7,000. Survey weights were used for first of them, which is actually a sample rather than a census of that 1 week. The two classes, origin class is in fact, the parents class is in fact specifically father's social class of the respondent, which makes more sense for these generations. Very small percentage, in fact, of British women of these people's parents' generations actually worked at all. So that would be less helpful. So it's father's class. And the destination class is specifically the person's age, own class at age 38, by which time, on this level of classification, most people's class has stabilized. Okay. Right. A few more words from that research question. Relative mobility. What we are going to consider, well, the individual, as I said, is mobile if they are in different class from their father now. But I'm not going to look at individuals in quite as simple a direct way as that. Instead, I'm going to consider mobility in terms of distributions across populations, specifically these birth cohort populations. And there we can have two kinds of mobility. One, which I'm not going to consider, absolute mobility. This means change in the univariate marginal distributions of those. For example, class one, the higher professional class, has grown over time. There are now many more people, relatively speaking, in that class than there used to be in parents and grandparents' generation. So if you draw a person at random from the parents' generation and a person at random from the children's generation, it's much more likely that the person from the children's generation is from a higher class and much less likely that they are from, say, the routine class. So, and that's, of course, a function of essentially structural change in the job market and society as a whole. But it's not the mobility I'm talking about here. Instead, I talk about relative mobility and immobility, which is to do with not the marginal distributions, but the joint distribution of these two variables, essentially the associations between origins and destinations. Or to put it another way, changes in differences in relative probabilities of landing in certain destinations depending on where you came from. And the easiest way to illustrate that is with a look at the data. So here's some of that. So this is for one of those six data sets, the 1970 birth cohort and men in that cohort specifically, about 5,000 of them, if I remember correctly. And what we have here is the mobility table, which is simply a square contingency table between origin and destination. So each person is classified in the appropriate combination of what their father's class was and what their own class was. And the numbers that you see there are the conditional probabilities estimated from that sample row-wise. So probabilities of destination given origin. And so let's look at some of them again to illustrate what happens next. Focusing on, again, on the extremes, let's take the four cells in the corners of the table, so the top left and the three purple squares. And why I take four, I'll explain in a second. So these are people who come either from what is here labeled higher salariate, that higher professional class is also known as salariate, because typically in British context, people who are in those occupations receive a salary rather than wages in terms of how they're paid. Not a terribly interesting point, but that's where the word comes from. So your people who came, whose father was here, versus people whose father was in a routine occupation. Those two groups. And then in the response direction, destination, let's consider only those who ended up in either class 1 or class 7, so that, hence the four cells. And look at those relative proportions within the row, where we see differences. So, if you came from a routine class background, your probability of landing in class 7 yourself was about twice your probability of ending up all the way in professional class 1. Whereas if you came from a salariate background, higher salariate, your probability of ending here in the same class was about 14 times your probability of going all the way down to the routine class. So we have, down here we have a 2-to-1 ratio this way, and up here we have a, 14-to-1 ratio that way, which is a big difference. And it's that difference that we, when I talk about associations here. So specifically that association, those four cells, we can summarize in the odds ratio, which is a useful measure of associations for unordered categorical variables. So specifically the one for those four cells I talked about is this. So it's a ratio of those two ratios, and I'll consider the log of it, so log odds ratios. So that's the log of 28, which is 3.29. Which is a big number, meaning lack of mobility. So that's the next thing to be clear about. Here, large associations mean lack of mobility. This is very large. It's indeed the largest in that one particular table because it's the sort of longest range mobility there is. So if in this table every row had the same percentages, so irrespective of where you came from, your chances in ending up in each of the different classes would be the same as in somebody from any other background, then all of the odds ratios would be 1 and log odds ratios would be 0. To the extent they are not, we don't have perfect mobility. So that's what you're talking about. Now, that was just the one odds ratio for those four cells. There are, in fact, 441 different odds ratios from the 7x7 table, capturing different aspects of class mobility, or mobility in different areas of the class space, so to speak. And I might be interested in any of them, or all of them, as a set at the end of the day. So at the end of all of this, I will also have a bit of a challenge in how to manage the results, and I'll say something about that at the end. Many of you, of course, will know that there are only 36 linearly independent log odds ratios here, but that's not relevant to what I want to explain and interpret. So it's the 441 that's the relevant number. Okay. Right. So that's the association between X and Y. Notice I haven't yet got to my research question, but I need to do this first. So we've looked at class of origin and class of destination. I'll call them later on X and Y. So that stands for that association. What the arrow means, I'll say more about in a minute. There's been a lot of research of this. You can do a surprisingly large amount of research based on basically just those mobility tables in different contexts, countries, generations, etc. And much of John Goldthorpe's work and Bess Bogoro's work is on this. We know various things about it. There are lots of strong associations. We're a long, long way from perfect mobility or perfect meritocracy, as it would be called, both in Britain and elsewhere. There is a lot of lack of mobility. There is also clear differences in strength of that lack of mobility. What you saw there, the longest range mobility is the least fluid, so to speak. That's why that was the largest odds ratio. Elsewhere, they're smaller, but they vary in other ways as well, in ways that we sort of understand. And finally, for this slide, and importantly for sort of policy discussion, to the extent we would like it to get better, if we think mobility is good, which we on the whole do, it would be nice if it was sort of increasing. There's very little evidence of that. Indeed, mixed evidence. People have come up with sort of statements in all directions, in Britain especially, that it's been going up, it's been going down, or it's been going nowhere. Most common conclusion is that it's going nowhere. It's basically roughly the same level of mobility for the past many decades, which is a little disappointing if you would like it to get better. And it is partly because of that that we want to introduce the main question now, the role of education in all of this. So I have a variable for education, which is based on highest qualification achieved. I don't particularly need to explain that. It's coded in four levels based on person's level of education achieved at by age 37, so the year before I code the class variable, by which time, again, most people's education level has certainly stabilized. Right. So what do I do with education? This is what I would like to do with it. The last phrase of the sociological research question, accounted for by class differences in education. So for that, let's draw this diagram, which is also on the board. First time in many, many years I got to use a chalkboard, so I wanted to do that. So we'll refer to it many times. So let's put education with the letter M there, M for mediator in the middle, because it's sort of, it's determined certainly in order of time between your parents' situation and your own eventual class position, and certainly coded so in my order of variables. The question here is that we've seen that there is a association of this kind. Now we're trying to unpack that arrow. And the idea is that it could be, to some extent, because of the role of education. These two arrows, in other words. The second one of them is obvious, association between your educational qualifications and your occupation, which is what our class means here. For example, many occupations require a university degree in order for you to be eligible for those particular positions. This one, which is education given class of origin, is basically the social differences in educational attainment. For example, that it is an observable fact in Britain, certainly, that people coming from sort of professional backgrounds, as by family background, are more likely to achieve, for example, university degrees. So that differences in educational attainment based on your background, in aggregate. So to some extent, we might expect, sorry, I should put this up, some of this XY association to be because of this path, so to speak, here. So the so-called indirect effect of origin on destination via education. And it is, and the question is, how much is going from there? This is an interesting question in the sort of public debate, policy context of this, because, for example, in Britain, there is a very strong sense in public discussion of this that it's all about that, that it's really it's essentially the same thing. Mobility is basically the same thing as educational differences, which would kind of be encouraging if you wanted a simple policy, one policy lever, which would be intervening here somewhere. If you are only able to remove those educational inequities through reform of the educational system or whatever, then mobility would follow. And there is a very strong sense that that's as simple as that. But it won't be as simple as that if there is a substantial element of this, the so-called direct effect, which would be any other factors from your social background that affect your chances of landing in different kinds of positions. Whatever it may be, social networks, social capital, cultural capital, all of those other things that come from family and that parents, quite rightfully so, in individual cases, work very hard indeed to give to their children, to improve their chances in this world, but which in aggregate create inequities in society. So what we want to basically do is to put a number on how strong is that indirect path relative to the whole. But first we have to kind of figure out what I just said. What does it even mean to ask that question and answer it? And that's where we go to the statistical research question. So now, same graph, but I've removed the labels of the variables because it's no longer just about class and education. It's about any X, M, and Y. How we do this type of analysis for any such variables. So how can we define those kinds of effects and estimate them? What do they mean? Specifically, my kind of context, where I'm going to want to treat all of those variables as categorical variables, specifically unordered categorical variables, which makes sense for my particular class variables, at least. Those seven classes, by the way, are not fully in order in any meaningful sense. so we will treat them all as unordered. And when I want to estimate them as basically population characteristics for these particular finite populations, what I mean by that I'll come to very soon. Okay, so what does that mean in statistical terms? In terminological terms, this is a problem in an old word, older word for it is path analysis. Now it's much more often known as mediation analysis, where M is the mediator. You may or may not have seen any of it, depending on what you do. But one version you might have seen, for example, largely because this is the oldest of them, is this one, which is the mediation analysis or path analysis when applied to linear regression models, and hence basically continuous variables, at least for M and Y. So let's suppose you have this structure and you decide to write down these two models. And it's worth pointing out that that's what we have. We have, even when in what I will do, we have two simple models. One for M given X, in my case, education given origin, one model. And second model for Y given X and M, in my case, destination given both origin and education. So let's suppose though both of those two models were linear regression models like so. No interaction here between M and X. And the coefficients, the slope coefficients, attached to the arrows as up there. Then if you integrate this over the M, you end up with a linear model also for Y given X alone, with in particular the coefficient of X in that being this function of the original three. With a very, very appealing formula, which also holds exactly for least squares estimates of these models. So it's very obvious to describe it in these terms that it's a this thing here, the total effect, splits up into the sum of two things, which are basically the coefficients along those two paths. The direct effect, which is just this path, and the indirect effect, which is the product of the coefficients along that other path. So there you go. That looks immensely simple and straightforward, at ease. But it's almost unfortunately simple, because the simplicity of this result sort of hides the fact that if you try to do it for anything other than linear models, it is not as simple. And it isn't even obvious how you would start generalizing it. And that's what this talk is about and explains how people have approached this problem. And once we've sort of done that thinking and that generalization, we realize that the essential first step is to step back and formulate it in a more general way, rather than to try to push forward from the regression results we just saw. And in fact, I will do that drawing on corresponding results in more recent causal inference literature, even though my effects will not be causal in a way I'll explain. And once it's all done, then we will have effects which, on the whole, are not functions of regression coefficients in any helpful or useful or simple way, and don't need to be. There's no particular need to play with the regression coefficients. Instead, we will play with fitted values in a minute. What we will also not get is an equivalent of this result, which is you take the total and it splits up neatly into the indirect piece and the direct piece. So we don't have that except sometimes approximately. But equally, I would argue, maybe in discussion, I won't say more about it, that is not necessary. And indeed, any idea of such a decomposition is essentially meaningless. So it's not a loss. However, having said that, I will show certain more general results, which are indeed, as it were, fully general for this situation. And if you do then at the end apply them back to the situation of the previous slide, you do get back exactly the usual linear regression results. So they are a special case of these results that I'm now going to talk about, but not in sort of obvious way when you look at them. But if you plug in the models, then they will pop out. Right. So how do we do that? Let's give some notation first. So those are my three variables, as per this diagram. X, M, and Y in that order. All categorical in my applied problem, so I want to derive methods and models where categorical, which work with categorical variables. Then I have data on them for some number of units, I, hence the subscript I. I think there's a finite population of capital N units from which we have a sample of small n units. Sometimes we basically treat the two as the same, so we regard our observed data as the population. Again, for reasons I'll explain. Then I will also need these variables for explaining a few things when I start from the causal effects. So I won't be using, I'm not aiming for causal effects, but I start from there in order to get where I want to go. So for the causal definitions, we use these, which many of you will recognize as the potential outcomes, which is one of the existing frameworks, perhaps the most common framework for formalizing and defining causal effects. So this development of the past 20, 30 years, and a very helpful development indeed for clarity of thinking about causal effects. So what we have here is, this is variable y, the potential outcome for that, for unit I, and the brackets x mean what would be the value y if x was set to value small x. So this is defined for all possible values of x. So for each unit, we imagine that there is, we perceive the idea of possible values of y that would result if we change the value of x or set it to different values. Only one of them, at most, is only ever seen and realized. And by definition, none of the others can. So this is properly parallel universe stuff, Star Trek definition. They are exactly the same moment and situation in everything. So by definition, you can only see one of them. So they're kind of hypothetical and weird, but equally they are hard to avoid thinking in these terms if you do want to imagine a causal effect. So anyway, these are the things which some of you will be very familiar with, and others maybe not. Similarly, we have a potential outcome for M given X, and then for Y, we can also think of potential outcome if we manipulated both X and M, hence the two in the brackets. And then you'll see in further notation, population distributions of P without a hat and estimates thereof from a sample are P's with hats. Right. What I'm going to now do with those is to define total effects. So that's just X and Y. Again, before I get to what I actually want to do. Because that, again, allows me to introduce most things relatively quickly. Starting with a causal effect, specifically the causal effect for one unit, total effect. That is essentially a comparison of what would happen to y if x had different values. It always involves conceptually two values of the cause variable. So what would be the value of y if I set x to small r, and what would be the value of y if I set x to s? If those two are the same, then x has no causal, or that particular change of x does not have a causal effect on y for that unit I. If they're different, then it does have a causal effect. Okay, well, this is proper Star Trek in the sense that we can never estimate that for a particular unit. The best thing we can aim for under certain assumptions is to estimate population distribution equivalents of them. So essentially comparisons of these guys between in the same population for the same units, but for different choices of that cause variable x there. So that's a population or average causal effect. What I'm going to be interested in are population associations, which are also comparisons between different values of x, or y, distribution of y given different values of x, but now with potential outcomes. So these are basically comparisons of conditional distributions of the values of y's and x's, which we now think of as fixed and existing values out there. So these are perfectly concrete things. So this is something that if you did a census of the population, you managed to measure y and the actually existing or realized values of y and x for everybody, these would be simple. This would be a cross tab. So there's nothing hypothetical about that. So here the challenge is that we don't see them for the whole population, but for a sample only, in at least my application. Okay. So they are different things, is my point. And for both of them, whether these or those probabilities, we can then define associations, for example, using log odds ratios, as previously explained. And we can estimate them, again, the total effect, and then we'll get into my stuff. The funny thing here is that even though the definitions are utterly different, the estimates are the same. So either way, what you use to estimate those is conditional probabilities in a sample or estimated from a sample, like so. So for the association, population associations, this is obviously just an analogy of that or the sample version. For the causal effects, the distributions of potentials, outcomes, they are not equally obviously the same thing, but they are the best estimates we can have. So both of these can be used for both purposes, but whether that's a good estimate of quantity of interest depends on, requires appropriate assumptions, which are different. So for my association quantities, which I'm going to be interested in, these are the assumptions of finite population inference, basically sampling assumptions, that we have a representative sample of y's and x from their joint distribution, or at very least the relevant conditional distributions. So one kind of literature and assumptions and formulation of what we're trying to do in statistics. For causal effects, these are, well, first of all, causal effect, even for those n, small n observations we have, these are the assumptions of causal inference, which, again, most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with. Essentially, the most familiar, which is the assumption of no unmeasured confounding, which is, for example, most easily realized if you do a randomized experiment. It's a very different assumption, but in a sense, it's kind of similar assumption because you can think of it and those causal assumptions as essentially assumptions of sampling the potential outcomes. Not sampling which people we have in the data set, but which particular treatment situations we saw for the people that we do have in the data set. It's sampling as well in a different way. And then the hardest case of all, if you want to draw causal inference conclusions about causal inference in a population beyond your sample, you need both, and they're separate. Okay. So not easy, even for the total effects, even before we get to actually what I'm talking about, which is the mediation analysis. So again, I will briefly, looking at the clock, explain how this works for causal effects and then come to my estimates, and then all of a sudden we're done. The rest happens quite quickly. So here's what it looks like for, so now the indirect effect, so when we bring the M in there. For a unit, single unit, an indirect effect, causal effect, is inevitably, has to be this. So, but I have to explain what it says. Notice these are potential outcomes. So the X star here is any fixed value of X, which we pick. So it's sort of, we hold X fixed there. This is the value of mediator resulting from particular settings for the X variable. So, and we compare them for different values here. So what that basically says is, let's imagine that M, the mediator for person I, changes as if in response to us having set X to R, while we still keep X itself unchanged. So M changes, but X doesn't. And then we imagine what would happen if we keep X still unchanged in the same value, but M gets the value that it would get if X had been set to S. So we allow M vary as if in response to changes in X, but X itself does nothing else, so to speak. So that's the individual level one. And again, we can only deal with population aggregate versions of that. This is a big area, as mentioned there, a very currently active area in causal inference, because it's kind of going beyond the basic case, and that's where the research frontier has moved a while ago. And you can read more about it if you are interested. And from that literature, we get, in fact, several versions. So when we come to this bit, the population average one, there are, in fact, different variants of it. This is the most common one, where what we have here is indeed the person's own potential outcome for the mediator. This is the hardest one of them. This leads to so-called natural indirect effects. Then more recently, in the causal inference literature, there have been slightly less demanding versions of this, where the M is not set to the person's own potential outcome necessarily, but to draw from a distribution. And the last one there removes the potential outcomes from the M, but keeps them for the Y and so on in ways which I don't really need to get into. This is sort of gradually making this a little less difficult. But these are all causal effects because there's at least one potential outcome in there. What I'm going to focus on, of course, is the one that you get when you remove the last potential outcomes from the definition and write something which is exactly analogous, but only for conditional distributions. And what that means, I'll again explain in a second. So the way we explain it in the paper is essentially this kind of logic. It follows from starting with how this formulating the causal effects and then sort of seeing how that translates when you don't care about causal effects. In fact, I landed here rather more directly than that without this path, but it's a useful way of explaining how we do it. And again, those are all probabilities of a sort, and we can do log odds ratios, as you'll see in a minute, of that. And again, same as total effects. Even now we have four possible target quantities. Every single one of them is estimated as function of exactly the same things from the sample. So it's again a matter of what is it that you want to do and how much you need to assume in order to be allowed to claim estimates of that quantity from this. So again, the causal assumptions are of one set, and the population association assumptions are basically, which I'm going to care about, are the sampling type assumptions. For the causal inference, these are in fact extremely difficult ones. For example, for that first one there, so-called natural indirect effects, there is in fact no randomized experiment whatsoever that will guarantee that it is valid. So even with the best kind of randomized experiment, you still have to assume certain confounding type things away separately. So it's really hard. Quite much of the time for those, the best thing you can really do is a sensitivity analysis, essentially. But I don't need to care about that because I'm looking at associations, so I want to simply describe these things, whatever they are, in my populations. Okay, but before I go there, last adjustment is I will do this, but here we have X, which is the sort of the value of the, in my case, origin class, which is fixed at a certain value in everything except for the mediation bit. Here it's a single fixed value, but I prefer not to have it a single fixed value because I don't have any particular special value that I would want to use in that role. Instead, I put a distribution on them. So there's an added sum here over a distribution for the x's, origins in my case, which we choose. It's not an estimate, it's a reference distribution, a choice by us. In my case, for example, we'll just use as the reference distribution the marginal distribution of origins in a particular cohort estimated from our data. Now, what does all that mean? Is the last thing I need to say before we're done. I'll get to the example. So I will be calculating these sorts of things, which are probabilities. And notice, by the way, they can be rewritten in a way which appears to have removed this arrow. So it does look like an effect that only goes via M now, which is the whole point. So I will have probabilities, as you'll see, and I will calculate log odds ratios from those probabilities. They are now new probabilities. And what are they? They're obviously not the same original conditional probabilities that you saw in the mobility table. What they're instead is essentially a set of probabilities in a, so to speak, standardized population or a synthetic population where some things are as in the real population and some things have been standardized, made, changed in a certain way. Before I kind of open up the next bit, just in case it makes sense to some of you or helps make sense of some of you, this is in fact the same kind of standardization. This is now not very kind of fancy stuff. It's pretty straightforward stuff. The same kind of standardization that, for example, happens in demography population studies when we calculate standardized mortality ratios or even the life expectancy figure in comparative ways with different populations. So we're basically fixing some part of a distribution, keeping the rest unchanged. Or even when we do, for example, the Stata software has the margins command for displaying, among other things, kind of fitted values from regression models. And there you can do things like, let's keep all of the values of the x's in a particular model as they are in our observed sample, but just fix one of them at some specific value, kind of create a sort of synthetic population that looks a lot like the original sample, but we have fixed this one explanatory variable at a particular value, and see what's the average fitted value from that model. to illustrate the model. It's that kind of standardization, ultimately, what we're doing here. So my standardized population has these properties. Starting from the middle, so in it, the rows, the new class, the origin classes, so to speak, are like the real classes in that in their educational distribution. So the different classes differ in from each other in that they have the same distributions of educational attainment as do the actual classes in society. The dependence of Y on X and M, in my case, how occupations depend on origin and education is unchanged. What changes is that I've sort of standardized the origin distribution. Everybody's origin class is drawn from the same reference distribution. So in effect, I've, again, taken out any other role from the origin class other than its effect on education and through that on destination. So back to the estimation briefly. This is just saying the same thing again, but to point out what this means so that it doesn't look strange. So everything we now need is this for different combinations of Y and M and X. Indeed, pretty much all of the possible combinations. So this is much, what we do here is most conveniently done with an appropriate matrix expression that does all the possible combinations in one go. But once you've got that, it's simple enough. And what we have here, these two things, are simply fitted values for models for those two things. Those two models, one for Y given X and M, one for M given X. In my case, those are basically both saturated multinomial logistic models. Or to put it another way, they are conditional probabilities from two cross tabs. So not very complicated at all. They could be non-saturated models, in which case all of these depend further on some parameters and so on, but that doesn't change the ideas. And then standard errors come from this because ultimately both of these fitted values and ultimately the whole thing and any functions of it like log odds ratios and so on are functions of the parameters of those two models, estimated parameters. So their asymptotic variances are functions of the asymptotic variances of those parameters. So applying the delta method sufficiently many times round, you end up with the standard errors for this. And again, it's not terribly involved at the end. Or if you don't want to do that, there's always bootstrap. But in the paper, we give the closed form formulas. Right. So now, summary of the statistical research question, and then I'll briefly show you the results from the applied the application. Just to summarize what I've been saying. Question was, how can we carry out mediation analysis of population association between categorical variables? The definition part, one way of motivating is take the way they do things in causal mediation literature and define a quantity that is like those but without potential outcomes. What they then mean in terms of interpretation is in these terms of hypothetical standardized populations where we've sort of removed one part of what's going on in the world and see how much is left, so to speak. And the estimation is, as I've just said, basically a matter of fitting two models and kind of combining their fitted values from them as needed. Okay, so that's that, which is ultimately not very complex at all. Now, and I'm conscious of the time, so I'll just show you three more slides, and then I'm done. We're going to talk. Reminder of the question, to what extent can the lack of mobility in the sense be accounted for education and the variation in it? Remember, this was the table you saw. This is the real world for the men in the 1970 cohort. This is the indirect world. So just now to make it absolutely clear, this is what we ultimately get having calculated those elaborate standardized probabilities. We can put them back in a table, and we now have the same table, but for this world where origin classes only differ from each other in how they are associated with educational attainment. So this is how much more lack of mobility is still left after we only have education. Notice, for example, well, if you look at the corners ones we looked at, you can still see there's a clearly difference. This is, that's bigger than that. Well, this is now bigger than that, but by much less. So there's still a strong association in that those corner cells. It's less strong now. But you also see changes. For example, this one's here, last two rows, the semi-routine and routines, classes 6 and 7. In the full mobility table, you can see pretty obvious changes, like probability of landing in a professional class, 13% for class 6. Routine class 7. 13 for class 6, 22 for class 7. If we only leave the educational differences, we have these rows, which are basically the same. Essentially saying that whatever lack of mobility there is between origins 6 and 7, it has nothing whatsoever to do with education. It really can't be accounted for by education, because these origin classes really don't differ from each other in educational attainment by to a sufficient extent to explain the lack of mobility. So whatever is going down here is something else altogether than educational differences, and so on. So the rest, which you can read in the paper if you're interested, you can find it through my homepage, is then trying to make sense of these, most of the time, essentially a ratio of these to those, essentially how much of the original is accounted for by education, bearing in mind this problem of 441 of those. So we then try it in various different ways in the paper, essentially using those 441 ratios as a sort of second stage of data and analyzing them. There's even a model for those ratios, one for each of the combinations. But I will simply skip to the answers because I've been slow. So that was the question. And looking at those results, first part of the answer, this is now in John Goldthorpe's elegant phraseology. How much of it is education? Not very much. So that the basically those ratios between the indirect education only versus everything are 50% or less. So there is a role that the educational differences play in explaining, accounting for what we see in lack of mobility, but it's not nearly as big as people seem to think. No change of the cohorts in either direction, really. So it's not, for example, the case that education has become increasingly important. No. There is a bit of a difference for women between women and men. There's the relative strength of the education component is bigger for women than it is for men, consistently across these data sets. less of the whatever imponderable other things are going on for women than for men. Again, both of them, it's a small amount, less than half, so to speak, but it's a bit bigger for women. And there are big differences in how big is the role of the education component in different parts of the mobility space. For example, you've just seen that when it comes to mobility at the sort of more routine end of the class space, education does essentially nothing. It has a bigger role for in anything involving the white-collar classes 1 and 2 and 3, and a bigger role for very long-range mobility and things like that, which I can talk about if we have time or in the discussion. But these are the sorts of answers that we then derive from applying this tool to those particular data to get the results that you just saw passing by your eyes. But now instead of carrying on, I will stop here and answer any questions about this that you might have. So thank you very much.